I'll rub your back and see that you get your pills. I'll help you. I won't talk if you don't want me to, but you can tell me everything, Eddie. Eddie, please don't go. Eddie, please. Please. He was striding down the hall to the front door now, walking blind, head down, moving as a man moves against a high wind. He was wheezing again. When he picked up the bags, each of them seemed to weigh 100 pounds. He could feel her plump pink hands on him, touching, exploring, pulling with helpless desire but no real strength, trying to seduce him with her sweet tears of concern, trying to draw him back. I'm not going to make it, he thought desperately. The asthma was worse now, worse than it had been since he was a kid. He reached for the doorknob, but it seemed to be receding from him, receding into the blackness of outer space. If you stay, I'll make you a sour cream coffee cake, she babbled. We'll have popcorn. I'll make your favorite turkey dinner. I'll make it for breakfast tomorrow morning if you want. I'll start right now, and giblet gravy. Eddie, please, I'm scared. You're scaring me so bad. She grabbed his collar and pulled him backward, like a beefy cop putting the grab on a suspicious fellow who was trying to flee. With a final fading effort, Eddie kept going. And when he was at the absolute end of his strength and ability to resist, he felt her grip trail away. She gave one final wail. His fingers closed around the doorknob. How blessedly cool it was. He pulled the door open and saw a checker cab sitting out there, an ambassador from the land of sanity. The night was clear. The stars were bright and lucid. He turned back to Myra, whistling and wheezing. You need to understand that this isn't something I want to do, he said. If I had a choice, any choice at all, I wouldn't go. Please understand that, Marty. I'm going, but I'll be coming back. Oh, but that felt like a lie. When? How long? A week or maybe 10 days. Surely no longer than that. A week, she screamed, clutching at her bosom like a diva in a bad opera. A week, 10 days. Please, Eddie, please. Marty, stop, okay? Just stop. For a wonder, she did. Stopped and stood looking at him with her wet, bruised eyes, not angry at him, only terrified for him and, coincidentally, for herself. And for perhaps the first time in all the years he had known her, he felt that he could love her safely. Was that part of the going away? He supposed it was. No, you could flush the supposed. He knew it was. Already he felt like something living in the wrong end of a telescope. But it was maybe all right. Was that what he meant? That he had finally decided it was all right to love her? That it was all right even though she looked like his mother when his mother had been younger, and even though she ate brownies in bed while watching Hardcastle and McCormick or Falcon Crest, and the crumbs always got on his side, and even though she wasn't all that bright, and even though she understood and condoned his remedies in the medicine cabinet because she kept her own in the refrigerator? Or was it? Could it be that? These other things were all things he had considered in one way or another, at one time or another, during his oddly entwined lives as a son and lover and a husband. Now, on the point of leaving home for what felt like the absolutely last time, a new possibility came to him, and startled wonder brushed him like the wing of some large bird. Could it be that Myra was even more frightened than he was? Could it be that his mother had been? Another dairy memory came shooting up from his subconscious like a balefully fizzing firework. There had been a shoe store downtown on Center Street, the Shoe Boat. His mother had taken him there one day. He thought he could have been no more than 5 or 6, and told him to sit still and be good while she got a pair of white pumps for a wedding. So he sat still and was good while his mother talked with Mr. Gardner, who was one of the shoe clerks. But he was only 5, or maybe 6. And after his mother had rejected the third pair of white pumps Mr. Gardner showed her, Eddie got bored and walked over to the far corner to look at something he had spotted there. At first he thought it was just a big crate standing on end. When he got closer, he decided it was some kind of desk. But it sure was the kookiest desk he had ever seen. It was so narrow. It was made of bright polished wood with lots of curvy inlaid lines and carved doojiggers in it. Also, there was a little flight of 3 stairs leading up to it. And he had never seen a desk with stairs. When he got right up to it, he saw that there was a slot at the bottom of the desk thing, a button on one side, and on top of it, entrancing, was something that looked exactly like Captain Video's space scope. Eddie walked around to the other side, and there was a sign. He must have been at least six, because he had been able to read it, softly whispering each word aloud. Do your shoes fit right? Check and see. He went back around, climbed the three steps to the little platform, then stuck his foot into the slot at the bottom of the shoe checker. Did his shoes fit right? Eddie didn't know, but he was wild to check and see. He socked his face into the rubber face guard and thumbed the button. Green light flooded his eyes. Eddie gasped. He could see a foot floating inside a shoe filled with green smoke. He wiggled his toes, and the toes he was looking at wiggled right back. They were his, all right, just as he had suspected. And then he realized it was not just his toes he could see. He could see his bones, too. The bones in his foot. He crossed his great toe over his second toe, as if sneakily warding off the consequences of telling a lie, and the eldritch bones in the scope made an X that was not white, but goblin green. He could see. Then his mother shrieked, a rising sound of panic that cut through the quiet shoe store like a runaway reaper blade, like a fire bell, like doom on horseback. He jerked his startled, dismayed face out of the viewer and saw her pelting toward him across the store in her stocking feet, her dress flying out behind her. She knocked a chair over and one of those shoe-measuring things that always tickled his feet went flying. Her bosom heaved. Her mouth was a scarlet O of horror. Faces turned to follow her progress.
Eddie, get off there, she screamed. Get off there. Those machines give you cancer. Get off there. Eddie, Eddie.
He backed away as if the machine had suddenly grown red hot. In his startled panic, he forgot the little flight of stairs behind him. His heels dropped over the top one, and he stood there, slowly falling backward, his arms pinwheeling wildly in a losing battle to retain his departing balance. And hadn't he thought with a kind of mad joy, I'm going to fall. I'm going to find out what it feels like to fall and bump my head. Goody for me. Hadn't he thought that? Or was it only the man imposing his own self-serving adult ideas over whatever his child's mind, always roaring with confused surmises and half-perceived images, images which lost their sense and their very brightness, had thought or tried to think? Either way, it was a moot question. He had not fallen. His mother had gotten there in time. His mother had caught him. He had burst into tears, but he had not fallen. Everyone had been looking at them. He remembered that. He remembered Mr. Gardner picking up the shoe-measuring thing and checking the little sliding gadgets on it to make sure they were still okay, while another clerk righted the fallen chair and then flapped his arms once in amused disgust before putting on his pleasantly neutral salesman's face again. Mostly he remembered his mother's wet cheek and her hot, sour breath. He remembered her whispering over and over in his ear, "Don't you ever do that again. Don't you ever do that again. Don't you ever." It was what his mother chanted to ward off trouble. She had chanted the same thing a year earlier when she discovered the babysitter had taken Eddie to the public pool in Derry Park one stiflingly hot summer day. This had been when the polio scare of the early 50s was just beginning to wind down. She had dragged him out of the pool, telling him he must never do that, never, never. And all the kids had looked as all the clerks and customers were looking now, and her breath had had that same sour tang. She dragged him out of the shoe boat, shouting at the clerks that she would see them all in court if there was anything wrong with her boy. Eddie's terrified tears had continued off and on for the rest of the morning, and his asthma had been particularly bad all day. That night, he had lain awake for hours past the time he was usually asleep, wondering exactly what cancer was, if it was worse than polio, if it killed you, how long it took if it did, and how bad it hurt before you died. He also wondered if he would go to hell afterward. The threat had been serious, he knew that much. She had been scared. That was how he knew. So terrified. Marty, he said across this gulf of years, would you give me a kiss? She kissed him and hugged him so tightly while she was doing it that the bones in his back groaned. If we were in water, he thought, she'd drown us both. Don't be afraid, he whispered in her ear. I can't help it, she wailed. I know, he said, and realized that even though she was hugging him with rib-breaking tightness, his asthma had eased. That whistling note in his breathing was gone. I know, Marty. The taxi driver honked again. Will you call? She asked him tremulously. If I can.
Eddie, can't you please tell me what it is?
And suppose he did. How far would it go towards setting her mind at rest?
Marty, I got a call from Mike Hanlon tonight, and we talked for a while, but everything we said boiled down to two things.
It started again, Mike said.
Will you come? Mike said.
And now I've got a fever, Marty, only it's a fever you can't damp down with aspirin. And I've got a shortness of breath the goddamned aspirator won't touch, because that shortness of breath isn't in my throat or my lungs. It is around my heart. I'll come back to you if I can, Marty, but I feel like a man standing at the mouth of an old mine shaft that is full of cave-ins waiting to happen, standing there and saying goodbye to the daylight.
Yes, my yes. That would surely set her mind at rest.
No, he said. I guess I can't tell you what it is.
And before she could say more, before she could begin again,
Eddie, get out of that taxi. They give you cancer.
He was striding away from her faster and faster. By the time he got to the cab, he was almost running. She was still standing in the doorway when the cab backed into the street, still standing there when they started for the city. A big black woman's shadow cut out of the light spilling from their house. He waved and thought she raised her hand in return.
Where are we headed tonight, my friend? The cabbie asked.
Penn Station, Eddie said, and his hand relaxed on the aspirator. His asthma had gone to wherever it went to brood between its assaults on his bronchial tubes. He felt almost well. But he needed the aspirator worse than ever 4 hours later, coming out of a light doze all in a single spasmodic jerk that caused the fellow in the business suit across the way to lower his paper and look at him with faintly apprehensive curiosity.
I'm back, Eddie, the asthma yelled gleefully. I'm back, and oh, I don't know, this time I just might kill you.
Why not? Gotta do it sometime, you know. Can't fuck around with you forever. Eddie's chest surged and pulled. He groped for the aspirator, found it, pointed it down his throat, and pulled the trigger. Then he sat back in the tall Amtrak seat, shivering, waiting for relief, thinking of the dream from which he had just awakened.
Dream?
Christ, if that was all. He was afraid it was more memory than dream. In it there had been a green light, like the light inside a shoe store x-ray machine, and a rotting leper had pursued a screaming boy named Eddie Kasprak through tunnels under the earth. He ran and ran. He runs quite fast, Coach Black had told his mother, and he ran plenty fast with that rotting thing after him. Oh, yes, you better believe it. You bet your fur. In this dream where he was 11 years old, and then he had smelled something like the death of time, and someone lit a match, and he had looked down and seen the decomposing face of a boy named Patrick Hochstetter, a boy who had disappeared in July of 1958. And there were worms crawling in and out of Patrick Hochstetter's cheeks. And that gassy, awful smell was coming from inside of Patrick Hochstetter. And in that dream, that was more memory than dream, he had looked to one side and had seen two school books that were fat with moisture and overgrown with green mold. Roads to Everywhere and Understanding Our America. They were in their current condition because it was a foul wetness down here. How I Spent My Summer Vacation, a theme by Patrick Hochstetter. I spent it dead in a tunnel. Moss grew on my books and they swelled up to the size of Sears catalogs. Eddie opened his mouth to scream, and that was when the scabrous fingers of the leper clittered around his cheek and plunged themselves into his mouth, and that was when he woke up with that back-snapping jerk to find himself not in the sewers under Derry, Maine, but in an Amtrak club car near the head of a train speeding across Rhode Island under a big white moon. The man across the aisle hesitated, almost thought better of speaking, and then did.
Are you all right, sir?
Oh, yes, Eddie said. I fell asleep and had a bad dream. It got my asthma going.
I see.
The paper went up again. Eddie saw it was the paper his mother had sometimes referred to as the New York Times. Eddie looked out the window at a sleeping landscape lit only by the fairy moon. Here and there were houses, or sometimes clusters of them, most dark, a few showing lights. But the lights seemed little and falsely mocking compared to the moon's ghost glow. He thought the moon talked to him. He thought suddenly,
Henry Bowers. God, he was so crazy.
He wondered where Henry Bowers was now. Dead? In prison? Drifting across empty plains somewhere in the middle of the country like an incurable virus, sticking up 7-Elevens in the deep, slumberous hours between 1 and 4 in the morning, or maybe killing some of the people stupid enough to slow down for his cocked thumb in order to transfer the dollars in their wallets to his own. Possible, possible. In a state asylum somewhere? Looking up at this moon, which was approaching the full, talking to it, listening to answers which only he could hear? Eddie considered this somehow even more possible. He shivered. I am remembering my boyhood at last, he thought. I am remembering how I spent my own summer vacation in that dim, dead year of 1958. He sensed that now he could fix upon almost any scene from that summer he wanted to. But he did not want to. Oh, God, if I could only forget it all again. He leaned his forehead against the dirty glass of the window, his aspirator clasped loosely in one hand like a religious artifact, watching as the night flew apart around the train. Going north, he thought. But that was wrong. Not going north, because it's not a train. It's a time machine. Not north. Back. Back in time. He thought he heard the moon mutter. Eddie Kasbrak held his aspirator tightly and closed his eyes against sudden vertigo. 5. Beverly Rogan takes a weapon. Tom was nearly asleep when the phone rang. He struggled halfway up, leaning toward it, and then felt one of Beverly's breasts press against his shoulder as she reached over him to get it. He flopped back on his pillow, wondering dully who was calling on their unlisted home phone number at this hour of the night. He heard Beverly say hello, and then he drifted off again. He had put away nearly 3 6-packs during the baseball game, and he was shagged. Then Beverly's voice, sharp and curious. What? Drilled into his ear like an ice pick, and he opened his eyes again. He tried to sit up, and the phone cord dug into his thick neck. Get that fucking thing off me, Beverly, he said. And she got up quickly and walked around the bed, holding the phone cord up with tented fingers. Her hair was a deep red, and it flowed over her nightgown in natural waves almost to her waist. Horse hair. Her eyes did not stutter to his face to read the emotional weather there. And Tom Rogan didn't like that. He sat up. His head was starting to ache. Shit, it had probably already been aching, but when you were asleep, you didn't know it. He went into the bathroom, urinated for what felt like 3 hours, and then decided that as long as he was up, he ought to get another beer and try to take the curse off the impending hangover. Passing back through the bedroom on his way to the stairs, a man in white boxer shorts that flapped like sails below his considerable belly, his arms like slabs. He looked more like a dock walloper than the president and general manager of Beverly Fashions, Inc. He looked over his shoulder and yelled crossly, If it's that bull dyke Leslie, tell her to go eat out some model and let us sleep. Beverly glanced up briefly, shook her head to indicate it wasn't Leslie, and then looked back at the phone. Tom felt the muscles at the back of his neck tighten up. It felt like a dismissal. Dismissed by m'lady. M'fucking lady. This was starting to look like it might turn into a situation. It might be that Beverly needed a short refresher course on who was in charge around here. It was possible. Sometimes she did. She was a slow learner. He went downstairs and padded along the hall to the kitchen, absently picking the seat of his shorts out of the crack of his ass, and opened the refrigerator. His reaching hand closed on nothing more alcoholic than a blue Tupperware dish of leftover noodles Romanoff. All the beer was gone. Even the can he kept way in the back, much as he kept a $20 bill folded up behind his driver's license for emergencies, was gone. The game had gone 14 innings and all for nothing. The White Sox had lost. Bunch of candy asses this year. His eyes drifted to the bottles of hard stuff on the glassed-in shelf over the kitchen bar, and for a moment he saw himself pouring a splash of Beam over a single ice cube. Then he walked back toward the stairs, knowing that was asking for even more trouble than his head was currently in. He glanced at the face of the antique pendulum clock at the foot of the stairs and saw it was past midnight. This intelligence did nothing to improve his temper, which was never very good even at the best of times. He climbed the stairs with slow deliberation, aware, too aware, of how hard his heart was working. Kaboom, ka-thud, kaboom, ka-thud, kaboom, ka-thud. It made him nervous when he could feel his heart beating in his ears and wrists as well as in his chest. Sometimes when that happened, he would imagine it not as a squeezing and loosening organ, but as a big dial on the left side of his chest with the needle edging ominously into the red zone. He did not like that shit. He did not need that shit. What he needed was a good night's sleep. But the numb cunt he was married to was still on the phone.
I understand that, Mike. Yes, yes. I am. I know. But...
A longer pause.
Bill Denbro?
She exclaimed, and that ice pick drilled into his ear again. He stood outside the bedroom door until he got his breath back. Now it was ka-thud, ka-thud, ka-thud again. The booming had stopped. He briefly imagined the needle edging out of the red and then willed the picture away. He was a man, for Christ's sake, and a damned good one, not a furnace with a bad thermostat. He was in great shape. He was iron. And if she needed to relearn that, he would be happy to teach her. He started in, then thought better of it, and stood where he was a moment longer, listening to her, not particularly caring about who she was talking to or what she said, only listening to the rising, falling tones of her voice. And what he felt was the old familiar dull rage. He had met her in a downtown Chicago singles bar 4 years ago. Conversation had been easy enough because they both worked in the Standard Brands building and knew a few of the same people. Tom worked for King and Landry Public Relations on 42. Beverly Marsh, so she had been then, was an assistant designer at Delia Fashions on 12. Delia, which would later enjoy a modest vogue in the Midwest, catered to young people. Delia skirts and blouses and shawls and slacks were sold largely to what Delia Castleman called youth stores and what Tom called head shops. Tom Logan knew two things about Beverly Marsh almost at once. She was desirable and she was vulnerable. In less than a month, he knew a third as well. She was talented, very talented. In her drawings of casual dresses and blouses, he saw a money machine of almost scary potential. Not in the head shops, though, he thought, but did not say. At least not then. No more bad lighting, no more knockdown prices, no more shitty displays somewhere in the back of the store between the dope paraphernalia and the rock group t-shirts. Leave that shit for the small-timers. He had known a great deal about her before she knew he had any real interest in her, and that was just the way Tom wanted it. He had been looking for someone like Beverly Marsh all his life, and he moved in with the speed of a lion making a run at a slow antelope. Not that her vulnerability showed on the surface. You looked and saw a gorgeous woman, slim but abundantly stacked. Hips weren't so great, maybe, but she had a great ass and the best set of tits he had ever seen. Tom Rogan was a tit man, always had been, and tall girls almost always had disappointing tits. They wore thin shirts and their nipples drove you crazy. But when you got those thin shirts off, you discovered that nipples were really all they had. The tits themselves looked like the pull knobs on a bureau drawer. More than a handful's wasted, his college roommate had been fond of saying. But as far as Tom was concerned, his college roommate had been so full of shit he squeaked going into a turn. Oh, she had been some kind of fine-looking, all right, with that dynamite body and that gorgeous fall of red wavy hair. But she was weak. Weak somehow. It was as if she was sending out radio signals which only he could receive. You could point to certain things, how much she smoked, but he had almost cured her of that. The restless way her eyes moved, never quite meeting the eyes of whoever was talking to her, only touching them from time to time and then leaping nimbly away. Her habit of lightly rubbing her elbows when she was nervous. The look of her fingernails, which were kept neat but brutally short. Tom noticed this latter the first time he met her. She picked up her glass of white wine. He saw her nails and thought, she keeps them short like that because she bites them. Lions may not think, at least not the way people think, but they see. And when antelopes start away from a waterhole, alerted by that dusty rug scent of approaching death, the cats can observe which one falls to the rear of the pack. Maybe because it has a lame leg, maybe because it is just naturally slower, or maybe because its sense of danger is less developed. And it might even be possible that some antelopes, and some women, want to be brought down. Suddenly he heard a sound that jerked him rudely out of these memories. The snap of her cigarette lighter. The dull rage came again, his stomach filled with a heat which was not entirely unpleasant. Smoking. She was smoking. They had had a few of Tom Rogan's special seminars on the subject, and here she was doing it again. She was a slow learner, all right, but a good teacher is at his best with slow learners.
Yes, she said now.
Uh-huh. All right, yes. She listened, then uttered a strange, jagged laugh he had never heard before.
Two things, since you ask. Reserve me a room and say me a prayer.
Yes, okay.
Uh-huh.
Me too.
Good night.
She was hanging up as he came out. He meant to come in hard, yelling at her to put it out. Put it out now. Right now. But when he saw her, the words died in his throat. He had seen her like this before, but only two or three times. Once before their first big show, once before the first private preview showing for national buyers, and once when they had gone to New York for the International Design Awards. She was moving across the bedroom in long strides, the white lace nightgown molded to her body, the cigarette clamped between her front teeth. God, he hated the way she'd looked with a butt in her mouth, sending back a little white riband over her left shoulder like smoke from a locomotive stack. But it was her face that really gave him pause, that caused the planned shout to die in his throat. His heart lurched, kabamp, and he winced, telling himself that what he felt was not fear but only surprise at finding her this way. She was a woman who really came alive all the way only when the rhythm of her work spiked toward a climax. Each of those remembered occasions had, of course, been career-related. At those times, he had seen a different woman from the one he knew so well, a woman who fucked up his sensitive fear radar with wild bursts of static. The woman who came out in times of stress was strong but high-strung, fearless but unpredictable. There was lots of color in her cheeks now, a natural blush high on her cheekbones. Her eyes were wide and sparkly, not a trace of sleep left in them. Her hair flowed and streamed, and, oh, looky here, friends and neighbors. Oh, you just looky right here. Is she taking a suitcase out of the closet? A suitcase? By God, she is. Reserve me a room, say me a prayer. Well, she wasn't going to need a room in any hotel, not in the foreseeable future, because little Beverly Rogan was going to be staying right here at home, thank you very much, and taking her meals standing up for the next 3 or 4 days. But she very well might need a prayer or two before he was through with her. She tossed the suitcase on the foot of the bed and then went to her bureau. She opened the top drawer and pulled out 2 pairs of jeans and a pair of cords, tossed them into the suitcase. Back to the bureau, cigarette streaming smoke over her shoulder. She grabbed a sweater, a couple of t-shirts, one of the old ship-and-shore blouses that she looked so stupid in but refused to give up. Whoever had called her sure hadn't been a jet-setter. This was dull stuff, strictly Jackie Kennedy Hyannisport weekend stuff. Not that he cared about who had called her or where she thought she was going, since she wasn't going anywhere. Those were not the things which pecked steadily at his mind, dull and achy from too much beer and not enough sleep. It was that cigarette. Supposedly, she had thrown them all out. But she had held out on him. The proof was clamped between her teeth right now. And because she still had not noticed him standing in the doorway, he allowed himself the pleasure of remembering the 2 nights which had assured him of his complete control over her. "I don't want you to smoke around me anymore," he told her as they headed home from a party in Lake Forest. October, that had been. "I have to choke that shit down at parties and at the office, but I don't have to choke it down when I'm with you. You know what it's like? I'm going to tell you the truth. It's unpleasant, but it's the truth. It's like having to eat someone else's snot." He thought this would bring some faint spark of protest, but she had only looked at him in her shy, wanting to please way. Her voice had been low and meek and obedient. "All right, Tom. Pitch it, then." She pitched it. Tom had been in good humor for the rest of that night. A few weeks later, coming out of a movie, she unthinkingly lit a cigarette in the lobby and puffed it as they walked across the parking lot to the car. It had been a bitter November night, the wind chopping like a maniac at any exposed square inch of flesh it could find. Tom remembered he had been able to smell the lake, as you sometimes could on cold nights, a flat smell that was both fishy and somehow empty. He let her smoke the cigarette. He even opened her door for her when they got to the car. He got in behind the wheel, closed his own door, and then said, "Bev?" She took the cigarette out of her mouth, turned toward him, inquiring, and he unloaded on her pretty good, his hard, open hand stroking across her cheek hard enough to make his palm tingle,
hard enough to rock her head back against the headrest. Her eyes widened with surprise and pain, and something else as well. Her own hand flew to her cheek to investigate the warmth and tingling numbness there. She cried out, "Ow, Tom!" He looked at her, eyes narrowed, mouth smiling casually, completely alive, ready to see what would come next, how she would react. His cock was stiffening in his pants, but he barely noticed. That was for later. For now, school was in session. He replayed what had just happened. Her face. What had that third expression been, there for a bare instant and then gone? First the surprise, then the pain, then the nostalgia. Look of a memory, of some memory. It had only been there for a moment. He didn't think she even knew it had been there, on her face or in her mind. Now, it would all be in the first thing she didn't say. He knew that as well as his own name. It wasn't, "You son of a bitch." It wasn't, "See you later, Macho City." It wasn't, "We're through, Tom." She only looked at him with her wounded, brimming hazel eyes and said, "Why did you do that?" Then she tried to say something else and burst into tears instead. "Throw it out." "What? What, Tom?" Her makeup was running down her face in muddy tracks. He didn't mind that. He kind of liked seeing her that way. It was messy, but there was something sexy about it, too. Slutty, kind of exciting. "The cigarette, throw it out." Realization dawning, and with it, guilt. "I just forgot," she cried. "That's all." "Throw it out, Bev, or you're going to get another shot." She rolled the window down and pitched the cigarette. Then she turned back to him, her face pale and scared and somehow serene. You aren't supposed to hit me. That's a bad basis for a lasting relationship." She was trying to find a tone, an adult rhythm of speech, and failing. He had regressed her. He was in this car with a child, voluptuous and sexy as hell, but a child. "Can't and aren't are two different things, Keed," he said. He kept his voice calm, but inside he was jittering and jiving. "And I'll be the one to decide what constitutes a lasting relationship and what doesn't. If you can live with that, fine. If you can't, you can take a walk. I won't stop you. I might kick you once in the ass as a going-away present, but I won't stop you. It's a free country. What more can I say?" "Maybe you've already said enough," she whispered. And he hit her again, harder than the first time, because no broad was ever going to smart off to Tom Rogan. He would pop the Queen of England if she cracked smart to him. Her cheek banged the padded dashboard. Her hand groped for the door handle and then fell away. She only crouched in the corner like a rabbit, one hand over her mouth, her eyes large and wet and frightened. Tom looked at her for a moment, and then he got out and walked around the back of the car. He opened her door. His breath was smoke in the black, windy November air, and the smell of the lake was very clear. "You want to get out, Bev? I saw you reaching for the door handle, so I guess you must want to get out. Okay, that's all right. I asked you to do something, and you said you would. Then you didn't. So you want to get out? Come on, get out. What the fuck, right? Get out. You want to get out?" "No," she whispered. "What? I can't hear you." "No, I don't want to get out," she said a little louder. "What? Those cigarettes giving you emphysema? If you can't talk, I'll get you a fucking megaphone. This is your last chance, Beverly. You speak up so I can hear you. Do you want to get out of this car, or do you want to come back with me?"
"Want to come back with you," she said, and clasped her hands on her skirt like a little girl.
She wouldn't look at him. Tears slipped down her cheeks. "All right," he said. "Fine. But first you say this for me, Bev. You say, 'I forgot about smoking in front of you, Tom.'"
Now she looked at him, her eyes wounded, pleading, inarticulate.
"You can make me do this," her eyes said, "but please don't. Don't, I love you. Can't it be over?" No, it could not, because that was not the bottom of her wanting, and both of them knew it. "Say it."
"I forgot about smoking in front of you, Tom."
"Good. Now say, 'I'm sorry.'"
"I'm sorry," she repeated dully.
The cigarette lay smoking on the pavement like a cut piece of fuse. People leaving the theater glanced over at them, the man standing by the open passenger door of a late model fade into the woodwork Vega, the woman sitting inside, her hands clasped primly in her lap, her head down, the dome light outlining the soft fall of her hair in gold.
He crushed the cigarette out. He smeared it against the blacktop.
Now say, I'll never do it again without your permission.
I'll never...
Her voice began to hitch.
Never...
Say it, Bev.
Never to do it again without your permission.
So he had slammed the door and gone back around to the driver's seat. He got behind the wheel and drove them back to his downtown apartment. Neither of them said a word. Half the relationship had been set in the parking lot. The second half was set 40 minutes later in Tom's bed. She didn't want to make love, she said. He saw a different truth in her eyes and the strutty cock of her legs, however, and when he got her blouse off, her nipples had been rock hard. She moaned when he brushed them and cried out softly when he suckled first one and then the other, kneading them restlessly as he did so. She grabbed his hand and thrust it between her legs.
I thought you didn't want to,
he said, and she turned her face away. But she did not let go of his hand, and the rocking motion of her hips actually speeded up. He pushed her back in the bed, and now he was gentle, not ripping her underwear, but removing it with a careful consideration that was almost prissy. Sliding into her was like sliding into some exquisite oil. He moved with her, using her but letting her use him as well, and she came the first time almost at once, crying out and digging her nails into his back. Then they rocked together in long, slow strokes, and somewhere in there he thought she came again. Tom would get close, and then he would think of White Sox batting averages or who was trying to undercut him for the Chesley account at work, and he would be okay again. Then she began to speed up, her rhythm finally dissolving into an excited bucking. He looked at her face, the raccoon ringlets of mascara, the smeared lipstick, and he felt himself suddenly shooting deliriously toward the edge. She jerked her hips up harder and harder. There had been no beer gut between them in those days, and their bellies clapped hands in a quickening beat. Near the end, she screamed and then bit his shoulder with her small, even teeth.
How many times did you come?
He asked her after they had showered. She turned her face away, and when she spoke, her voice was so low he almost couldn't hear her.
That isn't something you're supposed to ask.
No.
Who told you that, Mr. Rogers?
He took her face in one hand, thumb pressing deep into one cheek, fingers pressing into the other, palm cupping her chin in between.
You talk to Tom, he said. You hear me, Bev? Talk to Papa.
Three,
she said reluctantly.
Good, he said. You can have a cigarette.
She looked at him distrustfully, her red hair spread over the pillows, wearing nothing but a pair of hip-hugger panties. Just looking at her that way got his motor turning over again. He nodded.
Go on, he said. That's all right.
They had been married in a civil ceremony 3 months later. Two of his friends had come. The only friend of hers to attend had been Kay McCall, whom Tom called that titsy women's lib bitch. All of these memories went through Tom's mind in a space of seconds, like a speeded-up piece of film as he stood in the doorway watching her. She had gone on to the bottom drawer of what she sometimes called her weekend bureau, and now she was tossing underwear into the suitcase, not the sort of stuff he liked. The slippery satins and smooth silks. This was cotton stuff, little girl stuff, most of it faded and with little puffs of popped elastic on the waistbands. A cotton nightie that looked like something out of Little House on the Prairie. She poked in the back of this bottom drawer to see what else might be lurking in there. Tom Rogan, meanwhile, moved across the shag rug toward his wardrobe. His feet were bare and his passage noiseless as a puff of breeze.
It was the cigarette. That was what had really gotten him mad. It had been a long time since she had forgotten that first lesson.
There had been other lessons to learn since, a great many, and there had been hot days when she had worn long-sleeved blouses or even cardigan sweaters buttoned all the way to the neck, gray days when she had worn sunglasses. But that first lesson had been so sudden and fundamental. He had forgotten the telephone call that had wakened him out of his deepening sleep.
It was the cigarette. If she was smoking now, then she had forgotten Tom Rogan. Temporarily, of course, only temporarily, but even temporarily was too damned long. What might have caused her to forget didn't matter. Such things were not to happen in his house for any reason.
There was a wide black strip of leather hanging from a hook inside the closet door. There was no buckle on it. He had removed that long ago. It was doubled over at one end where a buckle would have gone, and this doubled-over section formed a loop into which Tom Logan now slipped his hand.
"Tom, you've been bad,"
his mother had sometimes said. Well, sometimes was maybe not such a good word. Maybe often would have been a better one.
"You come here, Tommy. I got to give you a weapon."
His life as a child had been punctuated by weapons. He had finally escaped to Wichita State College, but apparently there was no such thing as a complete escape, because he continued to hear her voice in dreams.
"Come here, Tommy. I got to give you a weapon. Weapon."
He had been the eldest of four. 3 months after the youngest had been born, Ralph Rogan had died. Well, died was maybe not such a good word. Maybe committed suicide would have been a better way to put it, since he had poured a generous quantity of lye into a tumbler of gin and quaffed this devil's brew while sitting on the bathroom hopper. Mrs. Rogan had found work at the Ford plant. Tom, although only 11, became the man of the family. And if he screwed up, if the baby shat her dighties after the sitter went home and the mess was still in them when Mom got home, if he forgot to cross Megan on the Broad Street corner after her nursery school got out and that nosy Mrs. Gant saw, if he happened to be watching American Bandstand while Joey made a mess in the kitchen, if any of those things or 1,000 others happened, then, after the smaller children were in bed, the spanking stick would come out and she would call the invocation.
"Come here, Tommy. I got to give you a weapon."
Better to be the whupper than the whupped. If he had learned nothing else on the great toll road of life, he had learned that. So he flipped the loose end of the belt over once and pulled the loop snug. Then he closed his fist over it. It felt good. It made him feel like a grown-up. The strip of leather hung from his clenched fist like a dead black snake. His headache was gone. She had found that one last thing in the back of the drawer, an old white cotton bra with gunshell cups. The thought that this early morning call might have been from a lover surfaced briefly in his mind and then sank again. That was ridiculous. A woman going away to meet her lover did not pack her faded ship and shore blouses and her cotton K-mark undies with the pops and snarls and the elastic. Also, she wouldn't dare.
"Beverly,"
he said softly, and she turned at once, startled, her eyes wide, her long hair swinging. The belt hesitated, dropped a little. He stared at her, feeling that little bloom of uneasiness again. Yes, she had looked this way before the big shows, and then he hadn't gotten in her way. Understanding that she was so filled with a mixture of fear and competitive aggressiveness that it was as if her head was full of illuminating gas. A single spark and she would explode. She had seen the shows not as a chance to split off from Delia Fashions to make a living, or even a fortune, on her own. If that had been all, she would have been fine. But if that were all, she also would not have been so ungodly talented. She had seen those shows as a kind of super exam on which she would be graded by fierce teachers. What she saw on those occasions was some creature without a face. It had no face, but it did have a name. Authority. All of that wide-eyed nerviness was on her face now. But not just there. It was all around her, an aura that seemed almost visible, a high-tension charge which made her suddenly both more alluring and more dangerous than she had seemed to him in years. He was afraid because she was here, all here, the essential she as apart from the she Tom Rogan wanted her to be, the she he had made. Beverly looked shocked and frightened. She also looked almost madly exhilarated. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.